Session number 13040.
Mr. Bungard, Reel 3. Can we go on to D-Day now, and can you tell me the preparations that you personally had to make for it and the job you had to do?
Yes, I have, ever since the war, read an awful lot of books about D-Day, about the Mulberry, and this, that, and the other, but there's a section missing, and this section was the one that I was on. Now, in actual fact, the fellows that were on this particular work of the construction of the Mulberry Harbour were volunteers. Normally, your name went on the list and you just went where they sent you, but they called for volunteers. And in fact, I volunteered not because I was a hero, but because I was in dead trouble. I'd been to see my young lady, who is now my wife, and I was adrift getting back, and I was in Captain's Report. And Captain's Report in Chatham Barracks was like being shot at dawn, and how to get out of it. And they asked for volunteers over the Tannoy, and I was down there like a shot. I thought this might be a way out. And they took my name and so forth, and told me to fall in, rig of the day, overalls, life belt, and sea boots, which shook me rigid. The mind boggled. Nobody knew what it was about. And they said they would give it a name, party pun and party game. We would be divided into two. There weren't many of us. I should think perhaps 30, 40 at the very most, they wanted in volunteers. And of course, we immediately called it Party Fun and Games. Anyway, we fell in. By this time, it was beginning to get dark. We were piled into a lorry, and off we went to the coast, which I believe was, on this occasion, Sheerness. And when we arrived, there in front of us was a huge office block without windows, 60 foot high, and we were told to clamber up on top, not knowing at the time or understanding that this lump of concrete was actually floating. And when we got to the top, we found it was just a huge hollow concrete box. And it was already tied up to a tug. We thought the tug was tied to it, but it was tied to the tug. And off we went, and went round Hell's Corner, which is Dover. And the thing is there, you see, that from Calais, it's quite easy to observe things happening on our side, although this was night. But they knew that we slipped things through at night and would often lob over shells, hoping they might just catch something. And they even used to shell Dover, of course. So there were we on top of this thing, and there was nothing we could do. We just had to sit there while we were towed along at 4 knots, which isn't very fast. It was about 3 miles an hour, I suppose, at the most. And we went through this corner. We used to see flashes from the French coast and wonder where the hell it was going, but fortunately it didn't hit us. And then, as dawn began to break, we found ourselves in a bay by Dungeness, where we promptly went down inside this concrete box, opened the sluices, and sunk it on the sand. And wondered what the hell we were doing, because nobody tells you anything, and probably it was just as well at that point. Now, we continued to do this for some considerable time before D-Day, and these things were towed round and sunk and placed all over the place in Dungeness Bay. We also took them round to Selsey Bill, near Portsmouth. And all this, of course, was in preparation for D-Day. Now, the big thing was that I've seen one or two stories where it said that we were hiding these in creeks from the Germans. We were not. We deliberately put these down in Dungeness, where they could be seen from Germany. They were remarked upon by Lord Haw-Haw, who said they'd never get to France, although he didn't know what for, because they were scattered in any, all over the place. They were in no shape. And I'm sure it was done deliberately to fool them to think that we were going to Calais, which I know the masterminds were trying to do. Well, eventually, of course, we got to a situation where we had to not go back to barracks every time, but be on somewhere more local. And we then went on to a ship, the Queen of Thanet and the Queen of Kent, two paddle steamers, which I had been used, I think, in the First World War for minesweeping, I believe. I'm not sure, but I was told that. Anyway, we only used these for food and for sleep. Most of our time was spent out on these phoenixes, were the code name of these concrete blocks, caissons. Some broke adrift. We tried to get one up and couldn't because our pumps were too small. And so they brought some civilian men across with huge pumps, and they pumped a phoenix out until it floated and annoyed us tremendously because they told us they were getting danger money. And we were doing this every day. We learnt a few things there because some of them didn't come up. They seemed to stick to the bottom, and we had some even breaking too. And unfortunately, even in wartime, you get civilians who are prepared to pinch anything or do anything selfishly, because it was quite obvious that those that did break up, someone had left out the cement or hadn't put it in. It was a bit thin on the wall, that sort of thing, you know, which is damned annoying. I mean, it goes on in building sites now. Someone knocks off a half bag of cement and so forth. Anyway, most of them were all right. And eventually, we ended up near Portsmouth at Selsey Bill. And at that point, we realised that we could walk across to the Isle of Wight on the shipping that was there. And these were filled up with American, Canadian and British troops, all waiting for the big day. We saw all the things that others had seen, all the massive aircraft and gliders going over. The ships sailed, and we were put in tow. Now, it's going to take us an awful long time to get over there, because we can't do more than 4 knots. The bow, if you could call it a bow, the bow and the stern were exactly the same, were just flat, with a slight sweep up that way. So that you just couldn't tear along with these things. Mounted in the centre at the top was an anti-aircraft gun, but it couldn't be fired, because if it did, the thing would break up and couldn't be used until it settled down in the water on the other side. So that was useless, and there were two soldiers who just sort of had emergency rations and slept underneath it. There were four of us. It was an able seaman in charge, a signalman, and two ordinary seamen. And we soon realised why they asked for volunteers, because these things had never been taken across an ocean. I mean, it was like trying to take a brick across the Thames. And off we went. And now, our biggest worry, of course, was E-boats or subs. We didn't see any subs, and I don't think any subs ever got near us. The Navy kept them off. But the E-boats did. The E-boats, in actual fact, sunk two. not one I was on, but they did sink two. And we had no protection whatsoever, and if we were hit with a torpedo, that would be the end. There was no, we were 60 feet up in the air, it was all concrete. It would just disintegrate. So it was a pretty hopeless situation, really. We got over to the other side, and the first thing you notice as you neared the French shore was the number of bodies that were floating about in the sea. And there was an air RAF launch tearing round and just piling these bodies one on top of the other into the back of their boat. And as soon as we got there, we then got involved with the Royal Engineers, who would dive down and open the sluices, and we would be taken off and sent back for the next one. Now the trouble was, we had a 2-gallon can of water between four of us for drinking and whatever. Washing was out. It was bitterly cold. The only place we could stand on that concrete block was at one end on top, with no protection whatsoever. So most of the time we were frozen stiff. We didn't wash. We were absolutely filthy. And very tired. And we came back and we pick up one straight away and off we go again. The rations we had were British rations, emergency rations, which were better than the American. They were extremely good. They were in a wooden box. And inside there was always some sweets, some cigarettes, and there were soups and cocoa and things like that in self-heating tins. And this was terrific, because it could really burn your hands. It got that hot. And that was extremely good. I came back on one occasion with my shipmates on a tug, obviously a Thames tug, very low in the water swishing through the gunwales from the English Channel, and we were getting our feet soaked once more. and he brought us back to the wrong place. He brought us back to Portsmouth, and we were due back at Dungeness to pick up some from there to bring across. And I thought, well, they'll perhaps give us a shower, you know, a bath or something, and something to eat in Portsmouth barracks there. But they didn't. They just gave us a chit to go on the train, where we had to go up to London, from London back down to Dungeness to pick up our ship. Now, by this time, we were pretty tired, pretty filthy, pretty fed up, and we knew, as always happens, that one or two people hadn't been doing their trips over, and we'd been doing a lot. And it occurred to me that we would pass through Woking. And I said to my shipmates, if it stops at Woking, I'm out. Can you chaps manage to hide in London overnight and I'll meet you in the morning? So they agreed to this. Yes, yeah, some were Londoners. They agreed to this, and it did stop in Woking. And as I opened the door, of course I had no ticket, they had the chit to get through Waterloo, the place was full of red caps, who immediately looked at me and made their way towards me, and I had no ticket. And I saw a little porter boy, and I said, look, I'm on the run, get me out. And he opened an iron gate that went through the parcels office. And I slipped through and got away, got on a coach back to Ferndale Avenue here, where I promptly had a darn good bath and something decent to eat and a shave.
Getting away, get down to sleep in the bath.
Yeah. In the meantime, my girlfriend went down to my mother's and got me clean overalls and clean underclothes and so forth. And the following morning, I made my way back to London. And I used the loop line and not the main line so that I wouldn't get caught by the naval police. And I was just going on to the underground at Waterloo when there was a siren went and they closed the underground. They always did that because it goes under the Thames at that point. And of course the naval police by then had got interested from the other end and were walking down Waterloo towards me. I dashed outside and there was a taxi there and he said, I can't go until I've got my taxi full, which was the rule in those days. So I waved a pound note in his ear and he said, get in, and I was off. I met my friends at Victoria and we went down to Dungeness and no one ever knew the difference. And once more we went across. But by this time, of course, we were getting trouble with the storms. And we had lost some of these caissons with other colleagues who had started out just as the storm was beginning and they were lost at sea. And we don't know what happened to them. They must have just gone down with them. Which was unfortunate, and we were fortunate in not being in that. But on one occasion, on the way over to Arromanches, we were on a caisson and it began to leak like blazes. And the water was pouring in. We were supplied with a small pump, but honestly, I think I could have peed more water than came out of that pump. It was useless. And the water was coming in and the thing was taking on quite a tilt in one direction. And on the sides of these caissons were great concrete blocks which were intended, I think, to be used as anchors, but I'd never seen them used. They were huge concrete blocks with a cable tied to them and held to the Phoenix with wooden wedges and what have you. So I got the signaller to signal the tug and say, look, we're going to let one of these go, hoping it'll straighten up a bit because we're sinking. Well, we went down and we chipped away at this thing and eventually got it over the side, cut through the cable. And it didn't make the slightest bit of difference. In fact, it probably made matters worse because the other side then went over. And so I then sent another signaller and said, get a move on, we're going down fast. Well, the tug did put a spurt on. I suppose he must have put another knot on somewhere because you could hear it booming in the front against this great hollow box, the water. And we got it there, and we got it down in the right place. So it was worth all the effort. I think it was after that one that we came back and I ended back up in Chatham. The hated barracks. And the harbour was built. And although these concrete blocks were only supposed to last 18 months, in actual fact, even after all these years, a number of them are still there. Which I've seen, of course.
How many trips do you think you might have made?
I should think myself probably 4 or 5. It takes quite a time getting there and back, you know. I mean, even over there, at times the bombers would come over and drop mines in the harbour, or even bombs. Fortunately, I don't think they ever did any damage. I think they were spotted and were dealt with. But it's quite frightening.
So when a so-called crew went over on one of these caissons, mm-hmm. who was actually in charge of the crew?
A naval seaman, myself.
You were in charge?
Yes.
And how many of you were there on the caisson?
4 seamen, of course, and the 2 soldiers, but the 2 soldiers did nothing. I remember on one occasion I had to, in the mid-channel, I had to tell these soldiers off in no uncertain terms. I really did let go at them. I was bored, of course, bored to tears. There's nothing they could do. And I saw them smoking cigarettes. Now, quite honestly, a cigarette glow from an E-boat or a submarine can be seen miles away. And we were sitting targets anyway, so I really let rip.
How did they respond?
They threw them down quick. Down inside the thing, because everything went down inside. I mean, even if you went to the loo, you went inside the box. There were no facilities for that at all.
So you weren't provided with any facility whatsoever except these emergency rations?
No, just the box. Yeah.
Who do you think should have been in charge of it? What rank of person?
I really don't know. We were quite capable of coping with the situation.
Would it have been possible for them to have provided some facility, like a hut or something on it?
At one end, you could go down a small ladder, and there was a hole, that's all you can call it, and there was a type of room, concrete room if you like, no windows, nothing. Very claustrophobic, which over a period of time seems to have been used as a toilet for a good many, and none of us ever went down there. And the other thing was, of course, that inside there you would be absolutely trapped if you were hit with a torpedo. There'd be no chance at all. So I don't remember any of us ever using that room. Nobody ever went in there.
What made you think that other crews of caissons were dodging it?
Well, it seemed to be the same ones going over all the time. And on going back to the Queen of Kent, and on one occasion to the Queen of Thanet, there were fellows there who'd never been across, I know that. And they, at the time, were moaning about the doodlebugs that were coming over, because some of them were coming down in the sea near them, mainly because the RAF were tipping the wings with their Spitfires and brought them down, you know. But they weren't hit. I mean, it wasn't that bad, I mean.
Were you commended for what you did at D-Day?
No. No. Which I thought was rather annoying. But this little section, this little party pun and game, is completely missing from all records.
It was called Party Fun. Was the code name for?
Yes.
For the operation.
Mm.
What did you do once your work had finished on the caissons? Were you concerned with Normandy at all after that?
No, after the first ones were on the last caisson, you would ropes and pulleys and so forth would be thrown across, and you'd be pulling everything into line while the engineers would nip down inside and open the sluices. And then you were taken off, and depending what time of day it was, either you'd go on to a ship that was there to overnight, waiting for some means of transport back. We had all sorts of different transport back. I can remember coming back on an American ship, which was fantastic.
Why?
Oh!
Luxury.
Absolute luxury. First of all, on mounting the ship and being in charge of my little group, I went up to straight up to the bridge and saluted the captain. In fact, I chopped him off such a smart one, he nearly fell down. Weren't used to that sort of thing, asking what we should do, you know, and he just sent us down to have some coffee. But on the way back, they saw something, I think it was a buoy, and thought it might be an E-boat or something, and they called action stations and all the Americans dashed up to the guns. We in turn dashed into the galley and helped ourselves to the food. But we were treated very well by them, very well indeed.
Are you proud of what you did at D-Day?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Because the British Mulberry Harbour had better fortunes than the Americans.
Yes, that is the answer given, but I don't know. I've never had the confidence in the way the Americans do things that the way we do things.
What's the difference?
Discipline immediately. And they seem to, I think they launched their invasion ships and everything from much farther out at sea than we did. In fact, I think it was 11 miles out when they started launching their troops ashore. We went much closer than that. And from their behaviour generally, they do sort of panic a lot easier than we do. And I can remember even on this American tug that was bringing us back, I was on the bridge speaking to the captain at that time, when the lookout asked him if he could have a coffee. And he was told, yes, but don't be long. Now, a lookout never leaves his post, never. Because a submarine can hit you in 2 seconds flat. This really surprised me. I'd even seen a rating saying, disobeying an order from a petty officer, saying that's not my job. Well, he'd be slapped in irons in our Navy if he did that.
Now, can we jump ahead in your war career to the Russian convoy you were on, and can you tell me about going on to destroyers and how you came to be involved in that?
Please? Yes, well, I did a torpedo course, right, which didn't take long, and I then got sent to the HMS Zenith at Dumbarton. In fact, we commissioned it. And we were told at that time we were the youngest crew on a destroyer in the Navy. Yes, it was Dennis Yard in Dumbarton. And after working up trials, we went round the British Isles once or twice, and we went up to Scapa Flow. Scapa I hated. It was dark. And it stayed dark, and somewhere in midday I think we had about an hour of daylight. It's a miserable place. And then we set off on this Russian business. Now, just about everything that could go wrong did go wrong on that occasion. One knows about the terrible cold weather and all that. The ship was geared up for that, I must admit. I mean, all the depth charge throwers and so forth were well wrapped up and insulated, and guns and so forth against the ice and the snow. But